Americans need to remember that January 6th was very much a religious event. That's exactly what Christian nationalism wants to see, is somebody responding with authoritarian violence. I think the leading myth is that this is somehow some kind of fringe thing. Like, people look at the Capitol insurrection and they think, wow, that mob of people were just radicalized, crazy. Who are these people? This is not a fringe thing. This is very much a mainstream thing. We're talking about millions and millions and millions of people who can be activated.
Welcome to episode 93 of the Refuse Fascism podcast. This podcast is brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in this country. Thanks to all who have been sharing this show and sending us their thoughts. JJ M. Inquiring wrote on Apple Podcasts, "Great interview to start off the year. Is it fascism or not? And to stop the rise of white Christian male authoritarianism, do we have to call it fascism? Is there a difference between fascism and white Christian nationalism?" Taking a historian's approach, Professor Zimmer lays out his views. If you want to check out the episode she's referencing, that's episode 92. Paige Price on Twitter, in reference to episode 91, wrote, "This is an excellent episode from Refuse Fascism, starting from January 7th through the year 2021, the Refuse Fascism Year in Review." Nicholas M. Brown on Instagram, in reference to my interview with Chelsea Eppen in episode 90, wrote, quote, "As someone who came out of this worldview, thankfully, I can say your assessment is wholly accurate," end quote. And Rob Sub on Apple Podcasts wrote, quote, "Significant podcast. This is an important podcast given the people and events that are occurring in the U.S. today and have been for a couple of decades now," end quote. Thank you all for sharing your thoughts. Look forward to hearing and sharing more from all of you. In today's episode, we're sharing an interview with Dr. Samuel Perry. He is the co-author of Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism in the United States, which won the 2021 Distinguished Book Award from the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. And he's the co-author of the forthcoming book, The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. But first, we need to address the first anniversary of the January 6th fascist coup attempt. Here's the statement from Refuse Fascism. 1 year ago, we saw Donald Trump call forth and unleash fascist mobs to storm the U.S. Capitol. This was a violent coup attempt, the culmination of a rolling coup Trump had been announcing and carrying out for months. While it failed in the immediate sense, January 6th became a dress rehearsal and rallying cry to further harden a now battle-tested fascist movement and Republifascist Party. This vicious coup attempt morphed into a comprehensive strategy of election subversion and voter suppression, while Trump's loyal mobs, to this day, continue to storm the public square with threats of violence and terror. Wherever Republicans are in power, they have both rewritten laws and shredded the rule of law to hammer in their white supremacist, misogynist, and xenophobic fascist program. They have successfully undermined the very concept of truth, leaving tens of millions to be susceptible to the calls of demagogues and the vilest conspiracy theories. Biden and the Democratic Party have not stopped or slowed the advance of these fascists. Trump roams free to cement his hold over the GOP and run for president in 2024, while across the country, we are losing the right to abortion, voting, protest, history education, and free speech. Death threats against public officials have become routine, and Christian fascists on the Supreme Court openly dehumanize women with Roe v. Wade in their crosshairs. This past year has been marked not by healing and hope after the Trump years, but by the continued aggression and achievements of an embittered fascist movement without any accountability for the damage they've done. The January 6th coup attempt demonstrated that fascism is not just the worst of a pendulum swing. It is an all-out assault on the rule of law, aiming to strip democratic rights from whole groups of people they see as subhuman. Trump and his fascist movement have torn up the norms and thrown out the rule book. Yet the outrage and hopes of people on the side of justice keep getting diverted into the very channels that are being eviscerated and away from the kind of deep, mass, society-wide struggle that is needed. The Democratic Party has largely led people into inaction, passivity, and conciliation with fascism. This is a reality that must be confronted. Fascism can and is happening here and cannot simply be voted away. The question remains, what will the decent people do? Will the future be fascists or will we act? RefuseFascism.org unites with people from diverse perspectives to sound the alarm and prevent the consolidation of this American fascism. Now is the time for deep engagement on the roots, nature, and trajectory of the real and present danger of fascism and what is required to knock it off its course. Since the founding of RefuseFascism.org, our stand and resolve have not wavered. We pledge to the people of the world, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. Join us. You can find and share this statement at RefuseFascism.org. The fascist commemorations of January 6th broadcast both the divisions and stress points amongst themselves, but also the growing threat that they pose. The most glaring display of fascist power and audacity was their almost total absence from the Capitol on that day, firmly united in their rejection of the peaceful transfer of power and substantially delegitimizing Biden and even the office of the presidency. Gates and Green took pride in the attempted coup, calling for a repeat, while DeSantis, Lindsey Graham, and others minimized it, claiming Biden was quote-unquote politicizing chaos. Tucker Carlson did both while slapping down Ted Cruz to enforce the boundaries of the party line. Trump, for his part, used the occasion to once more escalate the big lie, calling the 2020 election a crime, stoking resentments, and undermining any future election that they lose. So as we collectively wrangle with what has transpired, what it represents, and the looming threat of American fascism, there were a few pieces that stood out to me from the past week for their insight on the dire situation, maybe even more dire than we realized 1 year ago during the final days of Trump's attempted self-coup. Sidney Blumenthal described the details of the planned coup in, quote, "the insurrection is only the tip of the iceberg," end quote, for The Guardian. Quote, "The insurrection was not the coup itself. It was staged as the coup was failing. The insurrection and the coup were distinct, but the insurrection emerged from the coup. It has been a common conceptual error to consider the insurrection alone to be the coup. The coup, however, was an elaborate plot developed over months to claim that the votes in the swing states were fraudulent. For Mike Pence, as the presiding officer of the joint session of the Congress, to declare on that basis that the certification of the presidential election on the constitutionally mandated date could not be done, to force that day to pass into a twilight zone of irresolution, for House Republicans to hold the floor, brandishing the endless claims of fraud, to move the decision to the safe harbor of the House of Representatives, voting by states with a majority of 26 controlled by the Republican Party, to deny both the popular vote and the electoral college vote to retain Trump in office, for protests to break out at federal buildings, and for the president to invoke the Insurrection Act to impose law and order, end quote. Jeff Charlotte wrote that, quote, "Joe Biden, unbound, won't be enough to save us," end quote, for Vanity Fair. Quote, "On this day of remembrance," declared Biden, "we must make sure that such an attack never happens again." There's an echo of never again in this sentiment, the two words with which we have long pretended that we held a line against genocide, even as it occurred again and again and again. We can be sure that there are more fascist attacks coming, if not from fascists breaking the law, than from their elected representatives making it. "Never forget the crime of the 2020 presidential election," echoed Trump in his second statement hours after Biden's speech. "The next coup attempt may well be, quote unquote, legal as state legislatures bend the rule of law, if not the arc of justice towards Trumpism," end quote. And Stephen March is pulling no punches with his new book, The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future, writing for The Guardian, quote, "The United States today is, once again, headed for civil war. And once again, it cannot bear to face it. The political problems are both structural and immediate, the crisis both longstanding and accelerating. The American political system has become so overwhelmed by anger that even the most basic tasks of government are increasingly impossible." He goes on to say, "There is one hope, however, that must be rejected outright, the hope that everything will work out by itself, that America will bumble along into better times. It won't. Americans have believed their country is an exception, a necessary nation. If history has shown us anything, it's that the world doesn't have any necessary nations." End quote. The thought of something being too horrible to contemplate is not reason to not think about it, hard as it may be. Thank you for joining me on this journey to understand what we're up against and what to do about it. And one more thing. For folks wondering why we focus so much on the assault on abortion rights, I just got to give a shout out to Dr. Gisela Moyeti for her tweet on January 6th, which was, quote, "A year ago, I pulled into a clinic where I provide abortion care and thought, where are all the protesters today? A few hours later, I found out. When I say the anti-abortion movement is a pillar of white supremacy in the U.S., I mean every word," end quote. So do we. So do we. It's important, I think, to recognize what Joe Biden said in his remarks, and so I don't want to go to the interview without touching on them. It's essential to point to the disconnect between any aggressive talking points on behalf of the Biden administration and their galling lack of meaningful action to confront fascism. At the same time, ideas do matter. Biden accurately and aggressively framed the events of January 6th as an attack, an assault on the rule of law, and an armed insurrection led by the former president. He made clear the strong, clear line connecting the coup attempt back in history to the Confederate rebellion to defend slavery. In some ways, he attempted to make clear that the threat is still alive and even growing, while at the same time, he claimed that, quote unquote, that is not who we are. He framed the struggle as one between America and democracy and goodness on the one hand, and a violent authoritarian movement under the sway of a demagogue on the other. Ultimately, Biden aims to seize onto the righteous anger and fear people feel to compel people into preserving order, not justice. This podcast exists because we recognize that to a great extent, what people do is determined by how they understand the world. As we unite with people from diverse perspectives to sound the alarm and prevent the consolidation of this American fascism, it's vital for people to understand that this battle isn't, quote, America versus evil, end quote, but humanity versus fascism. To those who say, this is not who we are, I gotta call bullshit, in a country founded on slavery and genocide. But even for those who still cling to the idea of America, in order to defeat fascism, we need to confront that, as revolutionary leader Baba Vakian says, your shining city on a hill is full of fascists. Today's guest, Dr. Perry, published an article in Time magazine with Andrew Whitehead on January 4th titled, "January 6th may have been only the first wave of Christian nationalist violence." They write, quote, "We are forgetting that January 6th was very much a religious event, while Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism on display. We must remember that fact because evidence is mounting that white Christian nationalism could provide the theological cover for more events like it," end quote. With that, here's my interview with Dr. Perry. To help us understand the role of Christian nationalism in the fascist movement to eliminate the rule of law and democratic and civil rights in this country, I'm grateful to be speaking with Dr. Samuel Perry, sociologist and author who focuses on the intersection of religion and power. Dr. Perry is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Oklahoma and the co-author of two books on Christian nationalism, Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism in the United States, which he co-authored with Andrew Whitehead, and his forthcoming book, The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to Democracy, and that being co-authored by Philip Gorski. So welcome, Dr. Perry. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So let's start off with a really light one. One that I'm sure you can just answer in just a few sentences is, what is Christian nationalism and how does it connect to what we see in Refuse Fascism is a larger fascist threat. And when we talk about fascism, we're really talking about once consolidated a movement that would eliminate civil and democratic rights.
I love this conversation. I think saying the F word is important. A lot of people are, I think, reticent to mention fascism or neo-fascism or proto-fascism. It's a difficult thing to compare somebody to Nazis or to compare a movement to that or to say that's headed in that direction. That seems to be kind of the third rail and people don't want to go there. But I think it's important to at least draw those parallels before they're right in front of us. So it's better to see those things coming. I think that's important. Christian nationalism. I'm so glad you asked because I love sharing about this area of research. Something with a long history. Christian nationalism is not just something that has appeared recently. White Christian nationalism in particular has been around even before the founding of the United States. The idea being that the nation is for people like us, white Anglo-Protestant Americans, and that it should always be thus. That ideology has been around before we were the United States of America. This idea that Anglo-Protestants in particular are the chosen people, that God has granted them special place in the world and that they can control the world through violence, through coercion, if necessary, through war, that God will bless those efforts. And so it is something that is evolved. And so I don't mean to say that like the white Christian nationalism we see now is the kind that we saw in Cotton Mather's day or something like that. But you do see a continuity. So back then it was Anglo-Protestantism. It was British. It was Protestant. These are God's chosen people. And the outgroup are Blacks who were enslaved and Native Americans who were being conquered and needed to be exterminated or pushed out so that white Anglo-Protestants could control the territory, the nation. That has evolved in several different ways. As we became a nation, the founding fathers were not white Christian nationalists. So I don't mean to imply that they would have consented. And in fact, a lot of what the founding fathers expressed went wholly against what we would see as white Christian nationalism. We could say that they subscribed to a broader form of civil religion. And there's a difference there. And I'll draw that distinction in a little bit. But we see white Christian nationalism emerge basically in times of heightened racial and cultural conflict. When the question gets asked, who is this nation for and who deserves to have power in this nation? Usually some form of white Christian nationalism starts to appear. In the early 1800s, it starts to appear again around the time of the Civil War. And after World War II, and obviously there's this continuity, there's this thread that white Christian nationalism always around, but again, it starts to get activated and to reemerge as a dominant force. Again, after World War II, Eisenhower and Billy Graham, because anti-communist push, who is this nation for? And what are we as Americans? Well, we are defining ourselves as Christian, middle-class capitalist, Christian up against those godless communists. And this is where Kevin Cruz's brilliant work starts to pick up the thread. Then we see it emerge again after the civil rights movement and after Roe versus Wade and really during the moral majority, right? Like, who is this nation for? Well, it's for good, moral, white Christian citizens like us that just keeps on reemerging. And so white Christian nationalism is an ideology. It is also a political strategy. This is where we can start talking about how people who don't necessarily believe in white Christian nationalism can use white Christian nationalism. So for example, Donald Trump. I don't think Donald Trump believes anything. Like, I wouldn't define Donald Trump as a Christian nationalist in the sense that he deep down believes this country belongs to like evangelical Christians who subscribe to certain theological. Donald Trump doesn't believe any of that. That's for suckers. That's the stuff that Donald Trump used. But he is able to leverage Christian nationalist language in order to build a base, to activate a base of really angry and scared people who feel like this country is being taken from them and want to get it back. So white Christian nationalism in that sense is both an ideology that mobilizes an audience, but it's also a political strategy that can be used to activate people. And it can be leveraged by actors who really just don't care either way. They just know they need to make a base very scared and angry.
I really appreciated that, especially the ability to like pull back the lens a bit and look at not negating like how it's transformed or the urgency right in the present moment, but where its roots in history lie, I think is helpful. And one of the things that I think is important for our listeners to really understand and is something that you communicated just now, but it has been echoed in other folks that we've had on the show, like Dr. Anthea Butler and Sarah Posner, is that this is a political movement, that it's not a religious phenomenon. And I think that a lot of people struggle with understanding that, especially people who believe in like a pluralist society, I think sometimes can negate the danger of Christian nationalism because they're viewing it through this is some sort of religious phenomena, you know, that whole right train of thought. I think that it's important to ground ourselves in It isn't that it's not a religious movement, but it's most fundamentally a political movement. Am I right in that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think something we try to emphasize, and this is something we find again and again in our study. So my research, though I love the research of Anthea Butler and Sarah Posner and Jason Stanley, I see his book up on the wall here, and his work has been so transformative in our own understanding of where this is all headed. In fact, I was just listening to How Fascism Works on Audible last week. It's something I've read and reread countless times. But our work is different in that what we've been trying to do is we have been trying to measure Christian nationalism statistically and to look at how pervasive it is and to try to understand its association with various other attitudes and political behaviors. So I think that's something that we as sociologists, I think, can contribute uniquely to the conversation and talk about, like, the breadth and influence of this ideology. And one of the things that we often find is that Christian nationalism works differently than religious commitment, as we often measure that kind of thing. So for example, in our studies, we often include measures, Christian nationalism that we've used again and again for the last 6 or 7 years. And we also include measures of religious commitment, like how often somebody goes to church or prays or reads their sacred text or how important religion is in their life and that kind of thing. And what we often find is that once we account for Christian nationalist ideology in predicting some outcome like attitudes towards gun control or xenophobia or racism or Islamophobia or something like that, what we find is that Christian nationalism and religious commitment go in the opposite direction. So Christian nationalism seems to incline white Americans in particular to be more racist, more Islamophobic, less willing to have the government regulate guns at all, very much pro-Second Amendment to the extreme, and very xenophobic. Once we account for Christian nationalism, religious commitment seems to go in the opposite direction. In other words, it makes them less racist. It's associated with lower levels of racism, lower levels of xenophobia, lower levels of even Islamophobia. And so, in other words, Christian nationalism seems to incline Americans to be the kind of neighbors that you really wouldn't want around or really wouldn't want to talk to. But once we account for Christian nationalism, religious commitment, as we traditionally define that and measure it, seems to make people pretty good neighbors. It seems to be associated with really, I think, pro-social outcomes. So we try to stress whenever we talk about Christian nationalism, we're not targeting deeply religious Americans here. Like, I'm not trying to say to religious Americans, you guys are the problem. You people who vote your values and you people who really love your faith and want it to integrate every area of your life. That's great. Like, I really think that's important and really kind of inevitable, right? Like, the majority of Americans still are Christians. But I think where we get into Christian nationalism is when you say, this country rightfully belongs to Christians, meaning people like me, and you mean like white, middle-class, culturally conservative, traditionalist people like me, and I am willing to adjust all institutions and formally institutionalize our dominance in American society and marginalize everybody else who thinks differently. That's Christian nationalism. And that's something that I think veers us into something that is proto-fascist in a scary kind of way.
I was going to ask this later, but I think it just ties nicely into what you were just talking about. People, in my opinion, you may totally disagree, but they frequently dismiss what you call Christian nationalism and what I call Christian fascism, constantly saying that their influence is waning, that they're fringe, that their days are over. And I just feel in my gut that what we've seen over the Trump years, but even in the past year alone, like, doesn't match that. They were, not only were they instrumental in bringing Trump to power, but they were instrumental in trying to keep him in power illegitimately. So I was just wondering, not that the point is like, I have a feeling, prove me right, because that's not how we should approach questions in the world, but I'm more wondering, how do you see their influence within the GOP, yes, but also more broadly in society?
That's a great question. So numbers does not necessarily amount to influence. If that diminishing number of people happens to be very unified and isolated and radicalized, they can actually be really quite dangerous, and that belies their diminishing numbers. So if you looked at surveys over the years, you would see that Christian nationalism, however we can measure it, it's difficult to measure that over time, but various ways we have to measure Christian nationalism, we see in Pew Research, we see in PRRI data, Public Religious Research Institute, and the General Social Survey. So by those three indicators and the Baylor Religion Survey, so various surveys that we have to measure these kinds of things over time in different ways, all of them seem to express that just like America is becoming more secular gradually, people go to church a little bit less. People believe in God a little bit less. There are more Americans who identify with no religious affiliation more now than ever. We also see that people subscribe to explicit Christian nationalist views less and less gradually. But this is the but. Just because you see a shrinking number of people who hold certain views doesn't mean the people who still hold those views are not being radicalized, unified, isolated, and activated. And that's why we have to think of Christian nationalism not just as an ideology, but also as a political strategy, because Christian nationalist sentiment has always been around. It can be reactivated in times where people feel like, oh, what's going on? There's a lot of tension. There's a lot of conflict. I'm scared because there's a virus and I don't know what to believe. And there's all this misinformation out there. And so white Christian nationalist ideology can be activated to unify a group of people to say, hey, we're the people who have your best interests in mind. Don't you wish the country belonged to you like it always has? Don't you wish we could take back our country and the values that we've always held so dear from those people who are threatening everything that is decent and good and wonderful? That is a Christian nationalist and a fascist tactic. It's to ostensibly unify us around this kind of common identity and heritage and history. And it's a myth. It's not necessarily true, but we rally around these myths and they unite us and they motivate us and mobilize us. And so it is correct technically to say that in terms of numbers, Christian nationalism and white Christian nationalism is declining statistically. And yet I would argue that it is just as influential now as ever, because those people who still hold to those views are self-aware and they're unified and becoming more anxious and fearful and angry. We have an article coming out in Time magazine tomorrow on January 4th. Just before the anniversary, where we argue that Americans need to remember that January 6th was very much a religious event. That's getting drowned out. Like all of the polls, all of the op-eds, they're talking about this as a very partisan kind of thing, like Democrats and Republicans. And we're forgetting, like, you know, there were Jesus saved signs and flags and crosses and prayer in Jesus's name on the Senate chamber that you can go and read the words to. I mean, these are—
The rally started with Paula White.
Yeah. I mean, we need to realize that this was an event where Christian nationalism was on display. And if we forget that, then we're forgetting one of the really dominant, I think, ideological coverings for this kind of violence that we see. And that is this kind of narrative of whites and Christians are victims in this country, and we need to band together by violence if necessary to make sure that we communicate. As the shaman said, that we need to send a message to all the tyrants, the communists, and the globalists that this is our nation, not theirs. That's almost word for word what he says. That's a scary statement, right? Like what that message was said after violently storming the Capitol. I think that kind of reality or unreality, as Jason Stanley would say, is I think, right at the center of what we see going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you're talking about in terms of the influence growing, even if the numbers themselves are diminishing, I think the point about them being so highly organized, own media apparatus, you know, their own communication channels, their own schools, their own, they have so much infrastructure in which to mobilize. I think that that's just an important thing for us to like remind ourselves of. When people are talking about them being fringe, well, they're still in many ways in power in places across the country.
Oh, right.
Even
exactly.
While they're not in the White House, they're in the state houses, they're in on the Supreme Court, even though I know that people get confused because it's now a Catholic. That doesn't matter when it comes to this movement. It's not your flavor of Christianity. It's because it's not a religious movement. Like, I think that you're able to put that to the side for the larger picture.
Yes. Well, and that's why we try to stress that this movement is not united by theology per se. Oftentimes the majority of people like this tend to be evangelical Protestants, but not the huge majority, right? Like you have white Catholics and you have white like mainline Protestants and you have even some secular Americans. That's where it starts to get really interesting, is you have unaffiliated Americans who don't subscribe to much of anything theologically, but in their minds, Christian just means good, moral, decent, traditional people. And so they're happy to say, yes, Christian nation, absolutely. Christian value. And they just mean traditionalism. They just mean people like us. And that's really what it's all about, is a common Christian as a very like broad identity to just refer to good, decent, moral, traditional white people like us. And that's where I think when this is something that I've also tried to stress elsewhere, and what we get to in our next book really is, I think what we're seeing in the United States, and I think Trump was an indicator of this, is we're seeing a Europeanization of Christian nationalism in the United States. Let me clarify what I mean by that. So historically, Christian nationalism, because we had this very strong evangelical tradition and language in the United States of morals and values, and we could always talk about like the character of leaders, Bill Clinton and boo Bill Clinton, you know, like, and his, you know, behavior in the White House, and like James Dobson, and all these people could come and say, you know, hey, we need to we need to value our Christian heritage and we need to vote for presidents with values and blah, blah, blah. So Trump comes on the scene. And obviously the reality of that hits and everybody has to acknowledge like this guy doesn't give a rip about like morals or sexual ethics or Christian values, doesn't know anything about Christianity at all. It's just absurd whenever he tries to talk about Christianity because he obviously doesn't know what he's talking about. And so it becomes obvious that all of these folks who are talking about Christian values or Christian leadership or Christian character or those kinds of things really just meant white conservatism. Like they just meant traditional values. They just meant people like us. And so what we've seen in Europe already, we've seen this for years. Europe has secularized and they still have like a Christian identitarian movement. But for them, it's obviously ethnic. Like it just means like not Muslim. It means like native born French or Belgium or, you know, or whatever. When they say the UK or our nation is for Christians, they just mean not Muslims. They mean not open to outsiders. They mean people like us. And in America, that's what it's starting to mean. It doesn't mean theology. It doesn't mean evangelical. It doesn't mean people who like want to be disciples of Jesus and model his kind of behavior in their lives. You can be secular and be a Christian nationalist now because really you just want to take back the country from the leftists and the socialists and the identity politic, Black Lives Matter, Antifa people who are so very scary. That's what it's come to mean. And I think the more it becomes that, the more we get to, I think, just a more openly fascist movement. You don't even have to couch it in Christian language anymore. Like you don't have to talk about values or character or Jesus. Let me give you an example. So while I've got Dinesh D'Souza on the shelf here, what does it mean to be a Christian in this kind of like context? Like what does Christian nationalism mean? I think this is a good example. So Dinesh D'Souza in his book, The United States of Socialism, and Dinesh D'Souza is horrible. Like he's a provocateur. He's a troll. Like his whole persona is troll. Like that's his whole thing. But when he's talking about Trump is on the way out and he's publishing this book and he's trying to give a charge to his largely white Christian readership. And he says, I'm going to close this book by spelling out what we must do. This is Dinesh D'Souza's, as he's concluding his book, he says, we're not going back. I'm not saying that the GOP needs Trump clones. I'm saying that we need a new generation of leaders who can assimilate the things that Trump does so effectively, fearlessly and gleefully. Trump has made it fun to beat the hell out of leftists and socialists. And even when Trump is gone, we must continue to enjoy the Trumpian experience of being a butt-kicking Republican Christian right-wing American capitalist. Think about all those things that he just said in there. Butt-kicking Republican Christian right-wing American capitalist. So in D'Souza's mind and that of his readership and the people like this who I think really want to institutionalize Christianity in American civic life and belonging and identity, what they mean is all of those things. You have what political scientist Liliana Mason calls this identity stacking, where you're developing these mega identities, like all of these things apply to me. If I'm a Christian, that means I'm a capitalist. I'm a Republican. I'm a right wing. I'm butt kicking. I don't take crap from anybody. And the Christianity that I think these people have in mind is that kind of Christianity. That's the kind of Christianity that we saw at the Capitol. The one that doesn't take any shit. The one that says, this is my country and all. I will physically tear down these gates to make sure it stays that way. You don't have to love your neighbor. You don't have to say, what would Jesus do? Donald Jr. the other day, and is this article that made the rounds on social media. Donald Jr. talks about how like this whole ethic of Jesus, of turning the other cheek and self-sacrifice has gotten us nowhere. And I think he meant that. Like, and I think Christian nationalists mean that. Tony Perkins, who is this big advocate of Trump and is on Christian radio, which is horrible. And I'll talk about that in a second. But Tony Perkins was asked, you know, back in 2018, I think, what about the affairs? You know, how can evangelicals support Trump? And he says, you know, well, we gave him a mulligan, and the interviewer asked him, what happened to turn the other cheek? And he said, well, Christians, we only have two cheeks. Christianity isn't this doormat that people can just walk all over. And we were glad that there was somebody on the playground willing to punch the bully. That's exactly what Christian nationalism wants to see, is somebody responding with authoritarian violence, right? Like it's why Christian nationalists are the most likely Americans to say, you know what stops bad guys with guns? Good guys with guns. More guns, right? Like never less guns. It's always more guns. You were talking about the media a second ago, and I think that this whole Christian media apparatus, and I would just strong amen to that description, because in my neck of the woods in Oklahoma, I live in central Oklahoma, we're the only Christian talk radio around. If somebody wants to listen to Christian talk radio, you listen to American Family Radio. It is nonstop. Other than like random sermons that they have from like evangelical pastors, the talk part of that, like the shows that they air, are constant culture war, misinformation about COVID, about vaccines, about everything is trashing Biden, before that, everything was just loving Trump, everything having to do with that. People call in and give testimonials on this Christian like talk radio thing. And they don't talk about how like, you know, I listened to your radio program and I didn't know Jesus, but I listened to your radio program and I met Jesus and now I love Jesus and I just want to be like Jesus. It's like, hey, I came from New York and I was a Democrat and now I've been listening to your radio program and now I'm a Republican. And that's the conversion story, right? Like you convert people to white evangelical traditional kind of worldview or whatever you want to call it, culture or culture war, you know, you're activating these kinds of people. You know, I think that's what we're seeing is we're seeing not only this narrative of victimization, but as these groups become more isolated within like information silos and social media bubbles, and everybody else is leftist, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, it's all radical leftists in control of Bezos and George Soros and all those kinds of conspiracy theories. They only listen to American Family Radio. They only read Breitbart and Fox News. They only watch Fox, or if we're lucky. Other than that, it's like OAN, well, like One American News or Newsmax, you know, or something like that. And I mean, I think that's a super challenging issue that we face is misinformation, information silos, and the kind of polarization that leads people to say, I can't even listen to you. I hate you and you hate me. And so we really have nothing to say to one another.
I think that is true to a certain extent that our attention, at least on this show and in our work, can't be having these reasonable conversations with people who have, in my opinion, this is not everyone on the Refuse Fascism editorial board or producer of the show's opinion, but have effectively been brainwashed. And I think that there is a need to really struggle with the people who, I don't think anyone's lost in a full sense. I think people's minds can be changed, but I think that our attention is best served not by those who are so entrenched in this, but those who are passively sitting and watching and being like, oh crap, and mobilizing them to see and understand it and confront the danger. One thing that I wanted to talk to you about, you kind of got to this in some of what you were saying earlier, but I wanted to dig a little deeper. You recently wrote, it's going to be not your latest Time magazine piece, but your December Time piece, was titled How Trump Stole Christmas and Why Evangelicals Rally to Their Savior. And it was about Trump's quote unquote Christmas greeting at First Baptist Church that turned into a straight up MAGA rally. In it, you noted that being there live helped you appreciate the centrality of Trump to what is modern white evangelicalism.
Right.
And one of the things that I found really helpful about it, because like you, I find a deep appreciation for quantitative data, you share some really what should be to anyone troubling survey data. Looking at August 2021 that you and your colleagues are currently analyzing, where you share that over two-thirds of white evangelicals felt that the 2020 election had been stolen from Trump. 63% believe the quote-unquote liberal media is widely exaggerating the threat of COVID-19 to damage Trump's chances at re-election. That as of, again, August 2021, these numbers, like, may have changed, I understand, a full 70% disagree that Trump had any responsibility for January 6th. I'm hoping you could explore a little bit more how and why it is. Why does he continue to be their savior?
Right.
And is it more than, or is it as simple as he's delivered them the goods?
In some ways, it's a difficult question to answer because you get told one thing and often you assume that, gosh, is it really that? It seems like it's probably some other things as well. And I'll explain that. If you talk to some evangelicals, they really see it as a transactional thing. Some of them don't necessarily think Trump is a Christian, don't think he's a good Christian, but they think he's for Christians. They think he's for people like them. And so he's their advocate. In Tony Perkins' words, we got tired of being pushed around by Obama and his leftists. And so Trump was the guy who was willing to punch the bully. And that's exactly how they see that, is Trump is their savior in the sense that he is the big, strong, tough guy who says, I don't take any crap from anybody and I'm going to fight for you. Before the 2016 election, he said this verbatim. I mean, this is, and I study religious rhetoric and politics and how politicians use rhetoric. And before Trump, I mean, you really have to understand like how most politicians and presidential candidates in particular would use religious rhetoric. They wouldn't use it in these blatantly culture war kind of ways. They would use it in a very civil religion kind of way, in a way to unify us, to talk about the values that we as Americans hold and cherish and unite us together. And Trump just straight up said, you know, like, hey, we can't say Merry Christmas. You know, if I get in office, Christianity will have power. Like, you won't need anybody else because Christians will have somebody who is their advocate. But Trump promised Christians that he would fight for And sometimes he would say generically people of faith, and other times he would say just Christians. We need to rally around Christianity the way other countries are rallying around their religion. And making those, I think, very explicit overtures to Christian nationalism. Partly evangelicals really just see this as Trump is our guy because he fight for us and everybody else hates us and we're victims, whatever. And maybe issues like that. Like, so Robert Jeffress called Trump the most pro-religious liberty, pro-life, pro-Israel president that we've ever had in our country's history. There's a lot to unpack. You know, how exactly was he pro-life? Well, he appointed Supreme Court justices that may actually overturn Roe. So in that way, he delivered. You know, elections matter because Trump was able to leverage, you know, the opportunities that he had to do that. I think they're very right to be able to say that. But you also got another group of people. And these are, I think, not necessarily like the faithful evangelicals, but more, I think, the white ethno-nationalists, more like people that we saw storm the Capitol, that they love everything about Trump. They think he actually is a pretty good Christian. And because in their mind, what a Christian is just a white nationalist. These people would probably be horrified and deny being explicit racist. They would probably say, like, I got no problem with Black people. I got no problem with people of other races. I'm just saying Black Lives Matter and Antifa, they're horrible. Just saying, like, these people would probably deny being explicit racist because everybody denies being an overt racist. And yet they would probably think Trump is awesome and Trump is a great Christian because he is for people like us. And these people are in evangelical churches. These people are sitting next to you in the pews. I mean, I think a lot of these studies that track these people from the Capitol, track them to North Dallas, you know, like North Texas and all of these like Pentecostal evangelical churches. And these people are like sitting next to you in the pews. And so these people love Trump. I will say this, this myth needs to just die for once and for all, that white evangelicals somehow held their noses and voted for Trump twice, that like they didn't want to and they wish it was somebody else. Not really, right? Like, because they chose Trump when they could have had Rubio and Cruz and Jeb Bush and Ben Carson, really people with legitimate evangelical bona fides, and they chose Trump.
I just wanted to cut in here to give like another even more recent example people that say that is, who did they stand by? Did they stand by their man who came from their world, who was them, Mike Pence?
Right.
Or did they back up Trump? Yeah. They went along with calls to hang their boy.
Yeah.
Well, and for that matter, then pretends that the day didn't even happen. Mike Pence, he is a true believer. Not only did he come from that world, it is not just a political tactic or a political strategy.
No, I think Mike Pence is really in that world and he knows how to talk it and he knows how to communicate that in a sophisticated way. But there's a reason why when Trump was being impeached and these folks really would have had Mike Pence as their president, they didn't want that to happen because Mike Pence is a wimp in their minds and he is not the guy who's going to punch the bully. He's not the fighter. He's not the warrior. And that is what Trump sold to white evangelicals, is I will be your advocate, your warrior. And that's what he still promised. I'll be your guy who fight for you. If you ever watch the video of Trump's speech at First Baptist Dallas, it actually was really hilarious because it was 10 minutes of Trump speaking. And half of it was just him doing what he does, which is just kind of rambling about kind of like everything's disaster, everything's horrible, all of these failures of the current administration and that kind of thing. And then he literally said it this time, like, and he looked down at his notes and he talked about how somebody had written that for him. If you read the speech, they've given me like, you know, he's like reading it out loud. And it's so obvious. Okay, so like every time Trump's eyes go down to read that, somebody else has given that to him because he has no idea what he's talking about. And he's scripted language about Christmas and about Christianity's America's Christian heritage and why this is so important. It has obviously been given to him. And then whenever he has to kind of engage with that language in any sophisticated way, he leans hard on his speechwriters. It's like a Ron Burgundy kind of thing, like from Anchorman, you know, like anything in front of the teleprompter, he will read whatever his handlers provide him. He's doing that. But, you know, it's fascinating to me as an academic. I look at him and I think Trump is such a goof, is such a clown. And I think, how can anybody think this guy has 1 ounce of sincerity in anything he says and is anything but a huckster and a charlatan? And yet, I think white evangelicals and people who subscribe to Christian nationalist ideology are so desperate for that warrior to fight for them because they see the writing on the wall. They see the numbers. They see demography is working its magic and older cohorts of these folks are dying off and the United States is becoming more diverse and secularism is growing in the United States. So these people see themselves losing cultural and political power and they are clawing and straining and desperate for somebody to say, I'll make it so that it never happens. I'll erase that fear and anxiety for you.
I think that that resonates a lot. And I think that we just have to combat the myth that somehow just by virtue of them being a minority, that they can't have power. And I think that just by virtue of there being like more of us, that doesn't erase the danger. And I think that there's so much of that around the world, and see that that does not match reality, that you can have permanent minority rule.
Yes, exactly. Let me use that as an opportunity to get into the study that dropped today that I posted on Twitter. So we had this research that we looked at how Christian nationalist ideology is associated with Americans' attitudes about voter access and participation. Because I think this is where the rubber meets the road these days. We've got all of these laws being put in place. We've got all this discussion about voter fraud and the 2020 election and making sure that whatever happened in 2020 can't happen again for Republicans, right? Like, and they are desperate to make sure, because they understand that, hey, in a lot of these really like battleground states, as more and more people of color, as more and more like young people who tend to vote Democrat are activated and brought to the polls, that they are going to have a difficult time winning these popular elections. Republicans, they've won one popular election since Bush, since 88. And so George W. Bush in 2004 was the last popular vote they actually won. Other than that, it's the Electoral College, right? Like, and they realize this is something that they are going to have a really difficult time winning unless they actively institutionalize their own advantage. And so that's why you see Christian nationalism is strongly associated with support for gerrymandering. It's strongly associated with support for the Electoral College, because that's where your influence and power will be sustained, is in gerrymandering in the Electoral College. In this particular study, we find that Christian nationalism is one of the most powerful predictors that Americans think it's too easy to vote these days, that voter fraud is rampant. And we asked these questions before the 2020 election, by the way. So like before Trump had ever talked about stolen election, Christian nationalism was already strongly predictive of Americans thinking voter fraud, voter suppression is a lie. They thought voter suppression is nonsense. It doesn't happen. Especially if you're a white Christian nationalist, you just completely deny voter suppression. Even things that sound that are reminiscent of like Jim Crow. Christian nationalism is associated that with Americans believing that, you know what, people should have to pass basic civics tests in order to vote in the United States, or we should disenfranchise certain felons for life so that they can never vote. And what does that point to? And remember, I talked about how Christian nationalism has a long history, and it's in many ways very cyclical and ebbs and it flows. Paul Weyrich is this co-founder with Jerry Falwell Sr. of The Moral Majority. And in 1980, Anthea Butler, I think, paints this picture beautifully in her book, White Evangelical Racism. She talks about how all of these movers and shakers are at this Christian rally, and all of these moral majority leaders. You know, you've got Tim LaHaye and Phyllis Schlafly and Ronald Reagan and Paul Weyrich. And Paul Weyrich goes on stage and he says, I think a lot of our Christians in our churches have the goo-goo syndrome, the good government syndrome. They want everybody to vote. And he says, I don't want everybody to vote. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the election goes up as the voting populace goes down. It's a very famous quote, right? Like, it gets repeated over and over again. And that was Christian nationalism to a Christian nationalist audience saying, we Christians need to make sure that it's not easier to vote. And in fact, it would be better for us if we made it harder. And I think we still see that kind of thing, that participation in American democracy should be limited to those who prove themselves worthy. And who are the worthy? Well, it's people who are like us. It's good, upstanding citizens who know our constitutions and who don't break laws, and, you know, like good Christian people who are going to win elections, right? Like, or win elections for us. And so this is where the minority, as you were just talking about, this is how minorities stay in power, is if you've ever read, this is one of the most important books, I think, written in the last 5 years, How Democracies Die by Stephen Levitsky and Ziblatt. It's a fantastic book that I would recommend to anybody. But what they describe, all of these situations in which you've got constitutional democratic nations who get hijacked by authoritarian regimes and leaders. And what happens is these people come into power often through democratic means. They legitimately win an election. And once they win that election, they start to pack courts. They start to adjust rules, what they call sidelining the referees. They make sure that anybody who would oppose them, any institutions that could oppose their power and their rule, are taken out or sidelined. They handicap the opposition to make sure that they could never lose again. I think what's going on here is, I think you've got a potential situation in which Republicans understand that, and Trump is in this as well, you've got people who understand that the possibilities of them winning legitimate elections anymore are dwindling because demography, because their views are genuinely unpopular and their candidates are genuinely unpopular and they can't win a popular vote. So what do you have to do? You have to make sure you make voting harder for those people that you don't want to vote. And Christian nationalism is one of the leading ideological drivers and coverings of this kind of anti-democratic move or maneuver.
I'm looking at the time, and I want to close out by having you talk to us a bit about your forthcoming book and what you think are the biggest myths regarding Christian nationalism or the danger that we face that you are seeking to dispel.
I think the leading myth is that this is somehow some kind of fringe thing. Like people look at the Capitol insurrection and they think, wow, that mob of people were just radicalized, crazy. Who are these people? And unfortunately, you look at the QAnon shaman wearing horns and screaming, and the image is just, you know, seared into everybody's brain. It looks so comical and ridiculous and over the top in a way that people can dismiss and be like, wow, those people were crazy. Look at that guy. And they don't see the crowd that just looked like the guy sitting next to you in the church. Because guess what? That was the guy sitting next to you in church who just happened to be radical. Like I go to church here in Norman and with my family, and we have people in our church who believe in a stolen election, and they believe that COVID is a conspiracy and that vaccine mandates are for tyrants, and that they'd rather die than get vaccinated because they have so thoroughly bought into this, I think, narrative, right? So this is not a fringe thing. This is very much a mainstream thing. We're talking about, even if it's not a majority, we're still talking about millions and millions and millions of people who can be activated by demagogues who want to like continue to spout misinformation along with their surrogates and their representatives and their advocates, their allies in the evangelical subculture or on Christian radio or in Christian kind of talk or writers who want to pose those kinds of things. So you're going to hear that these kinds of things are fringe and marginal, and statistically, they may not be the majority, but this is a powerful and influential group of people who really have everything to gain from us dismissing this as something that is just, oh, crazies, you know, like these people. Meanwhile, they are pulling levers and working behind the scenes to make sure that they have stacked the odds in their favor electorally, judicially, legally, legislatively, to make sure that they don't lose. You will have minority rule in this country if we don't pay attention. The democratic process is being undermined by a minority of people. And of course, why wouldn't they, right? Like, why would a majority undermine a democratic process? Only influential minorities want to do that because that's how you have to win an election if you're going to. And I think that's just where it gets really, I think, concerning. Where I think this needs to be addressed and tackled is at the level of like misinformation and purveyors of misinformation. I posted this on Twitter, I think yesterday, but Marjorie Taylor Greene was kicked off Twitter and was deplatformed. I get the concerns about freedom of speech. I get that. But free speech doesn't apply to like people inciting riots or people inciting violence or that kind of thing. And people just blatantly broadcasting, I think, easily demonstrable lies, and those lies that will cost people lives. And research shows, and this is what I posted on Twitter, that there are actually like numerous studies now that show deplatforming people is effective. They lose influence, right? And their lies lose influence. And so I think that's where this needs to be hit, is in this kind of Vladimir Putin style misinformation campaign and the whataboutism and the nihilism that comes from this, and people just giving up and saying, nobody's got the truth. It's all lies. So I'm just going to vote with my tribe. Everybody lies. I'll just vote for Trump. And rather than kind of saying, no, we need to fight for truth. We need to hold on to reality and defend that idea, and to make sure that we really do deplatform and marginalize, I think, the charlatans and the hucksters who I think are really intentionally sowing lies to sow anger and fear and confusion.
Thank you so much, Dr. Perry, for joining us and sharing your time, your expertise and perspective. You can follow him on Twitter at SOC of the Sacred. And a link to his forthcoming book is in the show notes. The book is The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to Democracy. It's co-authored by Philip Gorski. Before we close out, I want to give a special shout out to Refuse Fascism Chicago and others who protested this past weekend, the so-called March for Life, but what really is a march for female enslavement. Be sure to visit refusefascism.org this week, where we'll be sharing a special announcement unmounting a serious society-wide struggle for abortion rights. Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. I want to hear from you, share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics, guests, or lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman, or you can drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org. Or leave a voicemail by calling 917-426-7582. You can also record a voice message by going to anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and clicking the button there. Want to support the show? Good! It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, follow, subscribe, so you never miss an episode. Chip in to support our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. You can donate by visiting refusefascism.org and hitting the donate button there. or Venmo Refuse-Fascism, Cash App Refuse-Fascism. Donate $15 or more and you'll get 100 Abortion on Demand Without Apology stickers. And if you want to order more stickers than that, amazing, want to get beanies for your fam or cute pins with essential messages, head on over to the Refuse Fascism store at refusefascism.org. Thanks to Coco Das, Richie Marini, Lena Thorne, and Mark Tinkelman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode, so be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.